Now, to get into the sermon for today, my title is, What Makes a Successful Marriage? Now, you may have seen the cartoon of Frank and Ernest where this couple is sitting in front of the marriage counselor. There's a big sign there that says marriage counselor. And he's talking to the marriage counselor. He says, well, it all began at the wedding because when she came down the wedding aisle, she had the band play not the wedding march, but Hail to the Chief. Well, that kind of sets off a rather important formula for that coming marriage. Of course, that was just a joke. But nevertheless, I think when you realize that about 50% of marriages end up in divorce, something's wrong. Why are so many marriages not successful? What makes a successful one? Well, I'm going to give you about 5 rules today, and hopefully it'll be a benefit and a help. But let's begin here in Proverbs 18, verse number 22. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Now, that's the way it ought to be. But as we can add here in Proverbs 19, verse number 14, houses and riches are an inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. So it isn't just a matter of securing a wife, it's securing a prudent wife and certainly securing a proper wife, and it works both ways, husbands and wives. So whatever I'm commenting about today, keep in mind, it applies to both sexes. Now we look at what happened here. Let's go back to the book of Micah and notice this interesting comment here because it's talking about a particular requirement for a marriage state. And speaking of a time period here when world conditions are going to be rather dicey to say the least. In Micah chapter 7, we read here in verse 2, the faithful man has perished from the earth, and there's no one upright among men. And they scheme together, as we read in the latter part of verse 3, and verse 4, the best of them is like a briar, the most upright is sharper than a thorn hedge. The day of your watchman and your punishment comes. So the warning has been going out, now that day is coming. Now what's the warning here? This is what I want to get to in the next verse. Do not trust in a friend. Do not put your confidence in a companion. Guard the doors of your mouth from her who lies in your bosom. So it's saying here that this is a time period when no one can be trusted. And yet if there's any characteristic that reflects what a proper and a successful marriage should be, it is a marriage that's based on trust. And if it's not based on trust, it has a serious strike against it. Here we find in the book of Proverbs, chapter 31, a description of what is called the virtuous woman. And this virtuous woman we read here in chapter 31 and verse number 10, who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts in her. He can trust her. And in Proverbs 11, verse number 16, we read, a gracious woman retains honor. So she is a woman of reputation, and she's an honorable person, and she's trustworthy. Now again, as I state, that works both ways. Now you'll recall, I won't turn to the text, it's in Ruth, the third chapter, where, what was his name, was going to marry this Moabite woman. Let me turn to it because for some strange reason his name escapes me. Ruth chapter 3 and verse 11. Boaz, yes, Boaz. We read, and now, my daughter, do not fear, I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know you are a virtuous woman. So a woman's reputation goes with her. And so does a man's. That's why it says in the book of Proverbs, a good name is better than gold and silver. And if a woman's reputation is bad, it's generally going to stay that way. Even though such a one may have repented and no longer lives that lifestyle, people remember those things. But this was a virtuous woman. So she had the kind of qualities and character that is required for successful marriage. Now, right along with that, let's consider the matter of loyalty. Notice Judges 14 and verse number 17. We recall the incident with Samson. And he married this Philistine woman, or Philistine woman, however they pronounce it. I've heard it both ways. And these Philistines had threatened her, and she was frightened. So what did she do? Now she had wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted. That doesn't make for a very happy marriage celebration, does it? And it came to pass on the 7th day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. So she sold him out. Now, she did it on the basis of fear, I'm quite sure of that, but nevertheless, it does illustrate that things such as that can certainly enter in and destroy loyalty. Maybe when we realize that this word virtuous woman, certainly one of its meanings and a primary meaning of it is a strong, courageous woman. She's a strong, courageous woman. She isn't going to cave in to everything that comes along easily. Proverbs 12, verse number 4. Proverbs 12 and verse number 4. An excellent wife, and I'm reading from the New King James Version, the King James has virtuous, the same thing, but an excellent wife is the crown of her husband. Why? Because she's got a reputation, she's upright, she's respected, she's moral, and she is wholesome, and she's a very good, dedicated wife. But she who causes shame is like rottenness to his bones. It shames him, it's a disgrace. Now, you've all known people like that, and so have I, where the husband's been shamed by the wife and vice versa. Now, that doesn't make for a very happy marriage, and that certainly is contrary to God's law. Going back to the virtuous woman once again here, we read Proverbs 31, verse 12, she does him good and not evil all the days of her life. See, because of her devotion and loyalty, that's what she's done. And then as we read in verse number 29, many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. So the matter of being loyal as well as being trustworthy are very, very important factors in the success of a marriage. Now, what about cooperation? Well, notice, going clear back here to Genesis, the 2nd chapter. Genesis chapter 2 and verse number 24. A man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now, if they're one flesh, then they're companions, are they not? And if someone is a companion of yours, then you would certainly presume that they're going to be cooperative. Now, if you have a companion that's not cooperative, generally he or she will not be a companion too long. That's the sad part about a lot of marriages. There's not the cooperation that God expects. And again, let me emphasize, both man and woman are involved in this. But in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse number 1. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. Wives, likewise, be in submission to your own husbands. Now, ladies, I did not come up with that text. I didn't invent it. I'm just reading what it says. I'm probably getting ahead of myself to say this at this point, but I think it's certainly an appropriate thing that should be considered. When you marry, you're taking on a God-given responsibility that you did not have when you were single. And once you become married, there's a responsibility laid on you that is not laid on a single woman. And if you don't live up to that responsibility, which the Bible outlines quite clearly, what is God going to use as a basis of judgment for women, aside from being moral and upstanding and obeying the commandments? I'll tell you what it's going to be. It's going to be whether or not they lived up to what he requires of a married woman. Plain and simple. Now, the same is just as true with a man. When a man marries a woman, he assumes responsibility God's going to hold him accountable to. And if he doesn't live up to it, that's certainly going to be a part of his judgment, because that represents a character issue. Now, as we read here, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without the word may be won by the conduct of their wives. I've known wives like that. I've also known wives who are the opposite. But it does illustrate you do have a responsibility placed on you if you're a married woman, because you assumed that responsibility, and God says this is what this responsibility entails, and you will have to live up to it. As we read here, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Now, you know, maybe I'm sort of wrong to make this kind of a comment, but I've wondered, you know, if God saw the women who are his to be as respectful to their husbands as Sarah was to Abraham, I think he would almost fall out of his chair. Because we're living in a time period now when this women's movement and all the things involved in it and all of the complexes that go behind the battle of the sexes that started generations ago, probably aggravated to a large extent by males, but picked up by females, has brought about a whole atmosphere of disrespect between both parties. And it's a sad situation. In fact, I was reading on the internet yesterday, on one of the news items, this is about Israel. This kind of surprised me. I'm just giving a close estimate of the figures because they fall right in this range. But 56% of them, both men and women, feel it is appropriate on occasions for husbands to abuse their wives. 34% said no. So the majority of them think it's all right. In other words, what they're really saying is, both men and women, is they probably have it coming. That's the excuse that's awfully often used when a man abuses his wife. She had it coming. Well, I think I can safely say some of them sure asked for it. But you know, we're talking about the matter of cooperation here. That requires both parties. That's a responsibility that you've been given, both a man and a woman. A man's to support his wife and to be her guardian and her champion and to be the proper head of the house. But we're living in a world now today where women have been forced out of the home, they're forced into the workplace, and that whole atmosphere and environment is not conducive to that. It's against it. And it does, I think, in the long run, a lot more harm than good to the women. But it's one of those situations generated to a large extent by the kind of governments we have to tax the people to death. You go back and look at what the tax rate was back in 1900 compared to today. I remember very vividly in World War II, when my dad was sitting there and he got a notice from the government, and that's the first time they started taking a tax payment out of your salaries. Started under Roosevelt. They wanted to finance the war and they wanted the money right then and there, so they started deducting it from a man's payroll. They didn't do that before then. Now going back to the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, Ephesians chapter 5 and verse number 24, we read, therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Now look what it tells the husbands. Husbands, love your wives. You know, one of the most difficult things for a man to do and to be that way is to always be sweet and kind to his wife. Because what will happen is, a good percentage of the time, he'll be upset with his job. He'll be upset with his work. He'll be upset with some situation. He'll come in already, he'll have growling like a lion, and then his wife says the first little thing, and it's probably minor, then he'll blow up. And don't ask me how I know. So you have to realize it works both ways. And it does illustrate what God requires. Verse number 33.
Nevertheless, let each one of you so love his wife as himself.
Now, if he's going to be doing that, I can tell you there'll be cooperation between the two of them. You know, it won't be, it's either my way or the highway. And that's the attitude that a lot of people have today.
Well, I wonder what's going to happen when they stand up in front of the judgment and God says, oh, it's going to be your way or the highway, huh? How much fear did you have for me?
That's the trouble. There is no fear of God before their eyes in this world today, plain and simple.
So, in Proverbs, back to Proverbs 27 and verse number 15. Proverbs 27, verse 15. A continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike.
Works both ways, doesn't it?
What if you have a nagging husband? And he's not satisfied with this, and he doesn't like that. He's fussy here, and he's fussy there. It works both ways.
I do know there's an old saying I heard years ago. A woman who has horse sense is not a nag.
And that certainly is true. So we're talking about the need for cooperation in a marriage. A successful marriage is going to be based on trust and loyalty and cooperation. But it's also going to be based on love. Now what do I mean by the word love? That's quite broad. In a general sense, and the safest way to define it would be outgoing concern for the other person. Outgoing concern. It isn't all inward, it's outward.
Now go back to the very beginning here, Genesis chapter 2. Once again, and notice verse 18.
It is not good that a man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him.
She's a helper, isn't she?
We'll get to that a little bit later. But let me say this. She's not intended to be a slave. She's not intended to be abused. She's not intended to be taken advantage of. And if there's outgoing concern, any kind of a loving husband will realize that.
So a man has a responsibility, a very, very serious responsibility in that respect.
Genesis 29, verse 18. We know what happened to Jacob. Now, this is an example of love. We read here, Laban had two daughters, beginning here in verse 16. And the name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. And the word delicate here means weak. I don't know exactly what that meant, whether she couldn't see well or whatever the problem was, but he really had an attraction to Rachel. Now, Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. And he said, Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only like a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Quite a remarkable story, isn't it? 7 years. So that's an example of love. Outgoing concern. Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5 and verse number 28. So husbands ought to love their own wives even as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself.
Why? Because God joined the two together as one. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church.
So you see once again here what is involved in this outgoing concern that works both ways. Now, we talked about Jacob's love for Rachel. Let's notice an example here of a woman's love for her man. This is in the Song of Solomon. And as you read here in verse number 5 of chapter 2, in fact, there's a little subscription says here, superscription says here, the Shulamite to the daughters of Jerusalem. So she's the one talking.
And she says, he brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustained me with cakes of raisins, refreshed me with apples, for I am lovesick. Lovesick. And really, the fact is, when young couples fall in love, psychologists regard it as a form of sickness. You know, I remember that song. A lot of you wouldn't remember this. Jimmy Durante used to sing this song, you know, I'm not sick. You're not sick, you're just in love. Or any of you remember that song? And he'd get to the final end, he'd say, you're not in love, brother, you're sick. Well, that's just about what really happens in a case of real love. Now, of course, they finally get over that, but that's how it begins. That's the way it should begin. You know, we ought to try to keep those feelings up and nurture them. Now I want to consider one other thing here, and that is a matter we're looking at a successful marriage. And what do we want to look at? We also want to look at sacrifice. Willingness to sacrifice. Notice Genesis 2, verse 18. You see, it is not good that a man should be alone. I will make him a help comparable to him. A help. Now, remember what Jesus said. You know what the order is, really, in God's eyes? Order is the man and then the woman. That was the established order that God set in motion. So what do we find here? If she's a companion comparable to him or comparable to him, then what is she going to be doing? Obviously, she'll be doing a lot of sacrificing. Now, he will too, for that matter. But once again, it works both ways. Now, you go back here to example once again to Jacob. What happened here? Well, his old father-in-law pulled a real shenanigan on him. Came to pass in the morning that it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why have you so deceived me? And Laban said, It must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we'll give you this one also for the service which you serve with me still another 7 years. Then Jacob did so and fulfilled his week, so he gave him his daughter Rachel as wife also. So he had two of them. Now, all you have to do is read the account, and you'll see how happy that marriage was. Well, overall, you know, polygamy is not a happy situation, in spite of the fact that polygamists will try to insist it is. You read here, and you'll see the tension that existed between the sisters. But the fact is, Jacob had to sacrifice another 7 years of his time in order to have her. Now, did he love her? He certainly did. How many men would do that? I know one fellow told his girl, he said, well, he said, if you don't marry me now, I'm not going to wait for you. I'm just going to go marry somebody else. So she fell for it and married him. I should have told her right off the bat, this guy doesn't love me. But you know, when you're young and inexperienced like that, you don't always know those things, do you? That's why marriage is not for kids. Marriage is for a mature adult who can think soundly. Proverbs 14, verse 1. Proverbs 14, verse 1. A wise woman builds her house. What does she do? She does what's necessary to have a successful marriage. And if she's not going to do what's necessary, what kind of a marriage will you have? Will the husband and the wife be at loggerheads with each other, especially when it comes to child rearing? I'll tell you one of the worst mistakes you can make, and that is get up and argue with your husband in front of your children about child rearing. If you don't like the way he's doing things, talk to him in private. Never bring it up in front of the children. Because I can tell you, they'll pick it up very quickly, and you're setting yourself up for a disaster. You wait and see. How do I know? I've seen it happen dozens and dozens of times. Yes, she builds her house. She doesn't tear it down. And she doesn't end up wrecking the children and their character and their whole view about marriage, because that's what's going to happen. And they grow up being juvenile delinquents, and you wonder why. not hard to figure out. First Corinthians 7, verse number 34. There is a difference between a wife and a virgin. And this is presuming, see, that these unmarried women are virgins. You can't presume anything like that nowadays. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord. Well, she should, but I don't think many of them do nowadays. That she may be holy both in body and in spirit. She's truly a Christian woman. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. That's what she's supposed to do. Does that entail sacrifice? You bet it does. Now, if you've been thinking that the whole sermon is just based on human marriage, it isn't. What I'm really getting at is spiritual marriage to God. That's the real issue. Because I can tell you this, if you cannot learn to properly obey God in the marriage rules between a man and a wife, how are you ever going to be married to Christ? That's what the issue really is. Is the church marrying Christ? It certainly is. Notice what you read here in Revelation chapter 19, verse number 7. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb comes, and his wife has made herself ready. That's the church. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. He said to me, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. So, you know, what does that imply? That's going to imply there's some that are not called. Now, what's going to determine whether or not they're called to the marriage supper or not? What they do in this life. Ephesians 5, verse 26. You see, we read, husbands were to love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Why? That he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. That's the purpose. Entering into the kingdom of God is likened to entering into a marriage to God, to Christ. So that's what we really need to realize. That's why Paul says here in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse number 2, Paul said, I am jealous for you with godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. That's the church. So you see, the marriage relationship between human beings is a type of the marriage relationship between Christ and the church. And the same rules apply as far as being spiritually in the church and entering God's kingdom as apply in a marriage relationship. Let's take the matter of trust. How trusted can human beings be? Well, here's one good answer here in the book of Job. Let's go to Job chapter 4, verses 18 and 19. If he puts no trust in his servants, meaning the angels that revolted and rebelled, if he charges his angels with error, how much those who dwell in houses of clay? That's right. How much more humans? So if angels couldn't be trusted, certainly he draws a parallel here with humans. And in Job 15, verses 15 and 16, if God put no trust in his saints, and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less man, who's abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water? So what he's really saying here is the human beings are not the most trustworthy. That's what we're to learn. Now, we're talking about a relationship with God now. Of course, it often entails a relationship between us, between human beings, but certainly it entails a relationship with God. Psalm 118, verse number 8. Psalm 118, verse 8. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. Now, why does he say that? We'll see here in a moment. They can't be trusted, but God can. So when we're talking about a trust relationship with God, we're talking about something that works both ways. With God, it's infallible. With us, it isn't. It's something that must be developed as character. You're trustworthy. You can be trusted with the truth that God has given you. That's why we read here in the book of Samuel, 2 Samuel 22, and verse number 31. 2 Samuel 22, verse 31. As for God, his way is perfect. And who is a rock? The word of the Lord is proven. He is a shield to all who trust in him. Who trust in him. So you see, when we're looking at our relationship with God and Christ, it's built on trust. And that means we have to have trust. What about loyalty? Is that required? Well, let's go to Matthew chapter 24 and verse number 45. Matthew 24, verse number 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant? So when we look at loyalty, we can certainly say fidelity, faithfulness is certainly involved is a part of that. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord, his master, have made ruler over his household so to give them food in due season? Now notice above here, he doesn't say, who is the faithful and wise servant? Who is a? So it's a generalization here. It isn't applying to any specific person. And he says here then, blessed is that servant, to which one? The one whom his master, when he comes, will find him so doing. He's been loyal and faithful in his responsibility all the way through. 1 Corinthians 1:9. God is faithful. So you see, the characteristic that we're supposed to be developing, he already possesses as a part of his character. Fidelity, he's loyal, he's faithful. He's not going to pull out the rug from under you. He is faithful, by whom you were called into the fellowship of his Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. So trust and fidelity are a part of God's very nature and character. Now, it's to be reciprocated, isn't it? If we're talking about a relationship with God, then does God expect us to be like him? Certainly. Or to be like he is. 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you except such as common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above what you are able, but will with the temptation also present the outcome. Proper translation. He'll give you the foresight and the faith to see ahead, to be able to endure that temptation. Why? Because he's faithful. He's not going to abandon you. He's loyal. And that's what is required. That's also required of us. As we read here in Revelation chapter 17, And verse number 14. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. That's right. They never break that fidelity. They're loyal and faithful to the very end. That's what's required. Now, let's take a look at this matter of cooperation. Are we expected to cooperate with what God requires of us? Or are we going to be justified in dragging our heels on something? Notice Romans 10, verse number 16. Romans 10, verse 16. Here we had this Old Testament church. They failed. And why did they fail? But they have not all obeyed the gospel. They weren't cooperative. Now, you can't be cooperative with evil. When you see evil and things are going wrong, you better not cooperate. But when it comes to the matter of God and doing His will and doing what's right, you're expected to cooperate. For Isaiah said, Lord, who has believed our report? See, they did not have the faith, and they could not and did not cooperate. So what happened to them? Read what God said. He gave them a bill of divorcement. And He separated Himself from them. And they're in that state to this very day. 2 Corinthians 10, verse number 4. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God in pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Every thought. Now that's cooperation. That's what God requires. That's why overcoming is a lifelong proposition. It isn't something that's accomplished overnight or any short length of time. And in Romans chapter 6, verse number 17, God be thanked that though you were slaves to sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. You obeyed that form of doctrine. It's cooperation. Now, certainly God is not going to abandon you, and He's going to give every part of the promises that He made to uphold you and help you along the way. You've got to do the same thing in return. 2 Corinthians 7, verse number 15. Here he's writing about Titus visiting this church here, and he said, His affections are greater for you as he remembers the obedience of you all. They were obeying God. That's who you better obey. That's where you better be looking. That's who you better keep your eyes on. Because that's what God requires. Now, I commented earlier about the importance of love. You know, when you look at a marriage situation with people who understand the truth, it's quite a bit more stringent when it comes to the matter of someone who doesn't know. Because it's about a tripod of three things that are required. Character on behalf of both parties. A willingness to obey God and keep the truth. And a physical attraction. You're not likely to be very happy with somebody who repulses you. So that certainly is a factor. But the problem is, nowadays, that particular factor has been blown up way out of proportion, and that's been emphasized to the point where that's all everybody thinks about. Physical attraction. Nothing else matters. Well, I tell you, there's a whole lot more matters than that. That's just to get you started. From then on, it's a matter of obeying God and character. If you don't have those ideas, you don't have all three prongs of that tripod standing up there, it's going to collapse. So, let's go back here and notice what happened when God married Israel in the Old Testament period. Ezekiel 16, verse 8. When I passed by you again and looked upon you, indeed your time was a time of love. So I spread my wing over you and covered your nakedness. Yes, I swore an oath to you and entered into a covenant with you. And you became mine, says the Lord God. God didn't break that covenant, they did. Finding fault with them, the Bible says. They didn't live up to it. And all it was required was a physical law. They weren't required to keep it spiritually, intent and heart and mind. They couldn't even do that. Now, when we look at the matter of the New Testament era, we're looking not only at the matter of physical obedience to God, but we're looking at the matter of the heart and mind. Now, that love is reciprocal. Notice what we read here once again in Ephesians 5. Let's skip down to verse 25. I already touched on this before, but I want to hit it once again right here in this light. Husbands, love your wives. And what I want to emphasize here is, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. He loved the church. That's really talking about the New Testament church. Let's read talking about the both Old and New Testament. And for that matter, eventually the whole Gentile world. And then verse number 32. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. So you see, the marriage is merely a type of that. And if there's not a reciprocating love, it's all one way, it isn't going to work. But you know, God is not that way. God has undying love, and it does not die. Human beings just seem to be unable to maintain it for one or whatever number of reasons involved. But you read of Christ here in John 15 and verse number 13, and we read here, he says, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. That's what he did. Quite a contrast to General Grant, military general who commanded forces in the war between the states. You know what he said one time? He said, my profession is the only profession on the face of the earth where you send your friends out to die. That's what he had to do. All those soldiers were his friends because they were all in the same army. Well, Christ died for us instead. That's the love he had. And that's why we read here in 1 John 5 and verse number 3. 1 John 5, verse 3. This is the love of God. We want to have the love that God says he has. Well, this is the kind of love we have to have. That we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not burdensome or grievous. We keep his commandments. That's how we show love. That's how we reciprocate. All right, let's take the final one here. Let's take the matter of sacrifice. What did God do for us? Well, let's go back to Ephesians 5 and verse number 2. Ephesians 5, verse 2. Walk in love, as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. An offering and a sacrifice. Did he sacrifice himself? You bet he did. In fact, as you read here in the book of Hebrews, chapter 9 and verse number 26, he then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Verse 28, So Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. Did he sacrifice? He sacrificed his life. Are we expected to sacrifice? Absolutely. Notice it here in Romans 12, verse number 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. That's right. Holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Obedience. And certainly applying the rules that have to do with marriage in the physical vein if we're married. 1 Peter 2:5. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse number 5. You also, as living stones, are being built up in a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices accepted to God through Jesus Christ. Spiritual sacrifices. And certainly a lot of that includes obedience, and it also includes being thankful and appreciative for all that God has given us. And in Psalm 51, here's a very good summary statement by David in this famous 51st Psalm, where he repented after his sin with Bathsheba. And as he says here in verse number 17, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. Now, if you find someone that is stubborn, obstinate, self-willed, rebellious, insisting on his own way, refusing to obey God, and he's going to do what he wants to do, that's not a spiritual sacrifice. A spiritual sacrifice is a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. You will not hold in contempt. So let me just close by saying, when we're looking at the marriage relationship between a man and a woman, we're looking at the type of the marriage relationship between Christ and the church. And that involves trust, loyalty, cooperation, love or outgoing concern, and sacrifice. If those things cannot be learned in the physical relationship we have between husband and wife, it's not going to be learned in our relationship with God. That's why it's so important we understand what the real important issue of our being born on this earth really is all about.